Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
Our broadcast today is brought to you by Evolve Fish, providing products that represent atheists, humanists, scientists, skeptics, and sarcastics, with a huge inventory of good stuff bearing a huge host of messages. T-shirts, car window decals, jewelry, mugs, keychains, license plates, special deals on clearance items, so you always want to check that page. And of course, shirts, mugs, stickers, and more bearing the Thinking Atheist logo icon. I spoke with Tom, Margaret, and Gavin at Evolve Fish. We decided to do something special for the Thinking Atheist audience this month. Now through the end of October 2015, all Thinking Atheist merchandise is 25% off. That's a quarter off of everything on the Thinking Atheist partner page through the end of this month. And that includes the just added stainless steel travel mug and the aluminum water bottle. Log on and check it out. EvolveFish.com. Do you think I'm pretty? It's a question sometimes asked for a host of different reasons. From insecurity to vanity, it's not uncommon to hear someone say those words. Even in the classic fairy tale, the queen gazed upon her own face in the magic mirror, eager for validation. Mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the fairest of them all? The question continues to be asked today in various forms, most famously perhaps in Japan. It is the story of the Kuchisaki Onna. And the sightings of the Kuchisaki Onna began in 1979. Panicked accounts of an identical encounter, with many reportedly bearing identical wounds. Facial wounds. Wounds inflicted by an innocuous-looking woman wearing a surgical mask. In recent decades, especially during flu season, it hasn't been uncommon to see many of Japan's population donning those facial masks to avoid germs and prevent sickness. I see them from time to time when I'm traveling, even here in the United States. It's almost commonplace these days. But in this case, the case of the Kuchisaki Onna, the mask hides a grim secret. A secret revealed to those unfortunate enough for a one-on-one encounter. You're walking along. A woman approaches you. A woman wearing a surgical mask. When she stands mere inches away from you, she suddenly reaches up and tears away the covering, revealing a horribly scarred face underneath, her mouth ripped far beyond its natural edges, almost all the way back to the ears, her teeth forever forced into a sinister smile by the slight upward curve of the wound, the nose flaring, the eyes wild. The woman holds you with her stare, bringing one hand up to grasp you by the throat. And she asks you one simple question. Do you think I'm pretty? Now consider your answer before you speak. Yes or no, it will have consequences. Of course, your first thought is an honest one. One look at the shredded, maniacal mouth of a devil, and you're inclined to scream no and just turn away. This answer, causes Kuchisaki Onna to quietly, casually reach into her pocket to remove a pair of scissors. before plunging them into your beating heart. The answer literally costs you your life. So what's the alternative? Do you think I'm pretty? You force the answer you think she wants to hear. Yes. And this answer causes Kuchisake Ona to quietly, casually reach into her pocket to remove a pair of scissors before she carves into the sides of your mouth with great delight, cutting and molding and tearing until you bear the very same scar in the very same place that she does. As you lie there, cloaked in terror and pain, in copious amounts of your own blood, Kuchisake Ona quietly, happily replaces her mask, walks away, and disappears. There was so much widespread panic over these reports that some schools required all students walking home to be escorted by a parent or teacher for safety. Police increased their patrols on certain city blocks. Even as recently as 2003, she was spotted, this time in South Korea. And in 2007, a possible missing piece to this puzzle was uncovered by a coroner, whose curiosity pointed him toward an archive of records from the late 1970s, and the described case of a crazed woman who'd been out chasing children in the streets before she was struck by a car, her mouth torn by the metal of the car from ear to ear. And perhaps at that moment, the ghost of the Kuchisake Ona, the split-mouthed woman, was born. Do you think I'm pretty? The next time you're asked this question, take a good, careful look at who is doing the asking. Look for the wide eyes, the mask, the Kuchisake Ona. For if you have and survive an encounter with her, you just might walk away with a smile. Thank you so much for joining me for the broadcast tonight, an annual Ghost Stories tradition. Before I get any further into the broadcast tonight, I need to make a correction. We had a great show last Tuesday about the science of fear. Very interesting stuff about the human brain reacting to fear and how fear can help and hurt us. And I was talking about the fear of bridges, and I had mispronounced the term for the fear of bridges. I had simply read it. I got the phonetic wrong. I said it is Jephryophobia. It's Jephyrophobia. Jephyrophobia, Jephyrophobia. Someone in the comments section was kind enough to bring it to my attention. Jephyrophobia is the fear of bridges. And to everybody named Jeffrey, you have my apology, okay? The format for the broadcast today is much like the format of last year's show. I've got several sort of formally presented ghost stories that we'll have peppered throughout the evening. Many of these based in legends and quote-unquote eyewitness reports. And so I've got those, and then, of course, between those, we'll have submissions from our listeners as they've talked about the things that scared them, some things that at least felt like ghostly encounters. It's always interesting to watch skeptical people, people who don't believe in gods or even the supernatural, talk about these encounters. Quite often it ends with a statement of, I'm sure there's a rational explanation for this, but I don't yet know what it is. I'm not prepared to say it's God or ghost or something else. I just don't get that. I don't buy that. But something happened, and it creeped me out. And here's the story. So I've got a few of those on the broadcast. And then I will, once again this year, end the radio show with a completely original work. I wrote something for last year's show, and people responded in a hugely positive way and said they really enjoyed themselves. Will you do it again? And so I decided, all right, I'll do something else. I'll write something else specifically for the broadcast. I couldn't think of anything, right? I couldn't think of any really good ideas, anything that interested me. Ghost stories are like many other types of stories. In a way, there's nothing new under the sun. There are so many different elements to ghost stories that have been sort of reimagined. And that's what you have to do. You have to find a way to take older, familiar concepts and make them interesting again. But nothing was really interesting to me. I just couldn't get traction. 2 weeks ago, I woke up. It's 5 o'clock in the morning. My eyes all of a sudden just snap open. And right then, I thought, that's the story I want to tell. It just happened. So I get up and I rush into the studio and I start hammering away at the keyboard. And almost 5,000 words later, it was done. Okay, this thing runs well over a half an hour. It is a long form story. It's almost a short form audiobook. I at one point was in here hammering away and putting together all the produced pieces to it. And I worked on it off and on and changed and rewrote and did this and reproduced and experimented. Natalie walks in and looks at me and she says, "Do your listeners have any idea how much work you put into this stuff?" And I looked up and I said, "Probably not. But hopefully you'll enjoy what you hear at the end of the broadcast and it will be well worth all the investment made into it." Now, I would ask that you make a contract with me regarding the final story of the show, because it is a long story. I really decided this year, instead of just rushing in to the point where, hey, now we're in the action scene and getting to the climax of the piece, I want to take my time. I want to flesh things out. I really want to get a three-dimensional image in my mind of the people and the environments. I want to relax and go with it without feeling rushed. And that's exactly the angle I took with this story. If you are listening at a place where you can only spare 5 minutes at a time, don't listen to the final story. Not until you can get to a place where you can commit the time to be able to really absorb the story without distraction. And I hope you do enjoy it. Again, that's going to end the broadcast today. I had a listener named Megan post something to my Facebook page I thought was great. She said, "If you're lonely, dim all lights and put on a horror movie. After a while, it won't feel like you're alone anymore." Isn't that the truth? Sean sent me a message and said, "When my grandfather on my dad's side died in 2001, I had a lot of guilt. Grandpa's health had been deteriorating for a long while, and for the last several months, he'd been in a hospice center. My parents and brother visited regularly, but I always made excuses as to why I couldn't go. I really just didn't want to see Grandpa in that state. And then one day it was too late. I never got to say goodbye and tell him how much I loved him, and I felt selfish. The funeral was held in the small Northern California town my grandparents lived in, and we stayed at Grandma and Grandpa's house. I slept on the couch in the living room. The first night I woke up just at midnight when the clock chimed. Now it's important to note that Grandpa was a big man who used a walker for as long as I can remember, and the floorboards of the old house were audible under his weight. He was also, by necessity of his lack of mobility, very routine-based. After the clock woke me up, I heard Grandpa leave his room and walk to the bathroom, his normal morning routine. Then predictably, he walked through the living room toward the kitchen. I didn't see anything, but the sound of Grandpa walking through the house was unmistakable. I was frozen in terror, not because I'd thought he'd hurt me, but because of the supernatural element. Once in the kitchen, the sound went away, and I eventually relaxed enough to sleep. The next night after the funeral, the event reoccurred. This time, though, when Grandpa was making his way through the living room, I whispered, "I'm sorry, Grandpa. I love you." And the sound stopped. Max sent me a message and said, "I grew up with my Hispanic father telling the story of La Llorona. We lived in New Mexico and had never lived in Texas before, though I moved to the San Antonio area when I met my wife. I always wondered about the creek named Woman Hollering Creek until one day I Googled it." Well, Max, I just did the very same thing. Here's the general story. Woman Hollering Creek is located in central Texas, according to its Wikipedia page, and yes, the story has a wiki page. At one point, it crosses I-10 between Seguin, Texas, and San Antonio. The creek's name is probably a loose translation of the Spanish La Llorona, or the Weeping Woman, now called Woman Hollering Creek. According to legend, a woman who has recently given birth drowns her newborn in the river because the father of the child did not want the child, or simply runs off with another woman. The mother then screams in anguish from drowning her child. After her death, her spirit haunts the location of the drowning and wails forever in mystery. The legend has several different variations. There have been occasional sightings of the restless woman's spirit. By the way, according to legend, if you get too close to the creek, too close to the water, the hollering woman will drag you in, hoping that you are her child. I've heard a version of a story like this. It was called Cry Baby Creek, except it had to do with a mother and her infant child in a car accident. The car rolled off an embankment, dropped into the water, and sunk. The mother and child drowned in the creek. And now if you go to the creek and you listen, especially on a windy night, you can still hear the baby cry. There's a Crybaby Creek, I think, about an hour north of my hometown of Tulsa, but this particular legend has many different incarnations in many different places all around the country, perhaps even around the world. I've got Tommy on Skype. Tommy, you're on the Thinking Atheist Ghost Stories radio podcast. How's it going?
It's going good, Seth. How are you doing?
I'm well. Do you have a ghost story for us tonight?
Back in 2005, I was on my second tour in Iraq, and like most evenings, you'd spend it relaxing, cleaning your weapons and with your friends or just listening to some music. And one evening, I was listening to music with a friend who was a new agey spiritualist kind of person. And at the time, I was a fairly liberal Christian, and we'd had some interesting conversations before, but this particular night, we were listening to CD Discman with external speakers, and strange static came over the speakers, which was weird because it was a CD player and it sounded like someone dialing in a radio. So I stared at the speakers, and the first thought in my head was that White Noise movie. And I looked at my friend, and she kind of just stared back at me and then looked around. And I had this weird emotional feeling. And once it was over, I just was like, what was that? What's going on? And she said, well, it seems like you've been visited. And I was like, what do you mean visited? She said, well, there was an older man sitting in the chair behind you smoking a cigar, and there were a few others standing at the doorway. And I was like, you mean spirits? And she said, yeah, well, we're all spirits, just they have left their physical bodies. And I had this overwhelming sensation come over me, and it was like I just busted out crying. And to this day, I have like no idea why or what exactly happened.
You have no idea what prompted that emotional reaction to what had happened?
It was strange. It just came over me.
It is rather creepy, I'm sure. You were probably sitting there. Did you hear any voices, or was it just static?
No, just static. I mean, which is pretty much what I hear anyway when I watch, you know, those ghost hunter movies and stuff where they say they found, you know, voice in the frequency. You don't hear it until they say, oh, this is what it is.
It doesn't mean it was a ghost. It means you are either the host of a ghost show and or you are a pattern seeking human being. Right.
Right.
What's your take? Are you still a rationalist? I'm guessing. What's your take on it? Does any part of you go, ooh, spirits or what?
No, not spirits. It's still just one of those things that's always in the back of my head of like, you know, I wish I would be able to figure it out. But I have no idea. I don't know if my friend was playing some type of joke or what. Maybe, you know, equipment. I mean, I was on a military base, so there could have been distortion from any number of, you know, communications equipment or anything like that. I have no idea. But no, I don't chalk it up to anything supernatural or paranormal. I don't accept anything like that.
I mean, the subjective human brain can do a lot with a little, right? Once the imagination kicks in, all bets are off.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks for sharing your story. I hope you have a happy and safe Halloween, okay?
Thank you, Seth. You too.
Just to give you a frame of reference when he's talking about white noise, it's also called electronic voice phenomena, or EVP. This is when you supposedly hear a human or human-sounding voice from a tape recording in the white noise of a radio station or between stations, television, static, something like that. You hear an otherworldly message supposedly inside the static. And so while he was telling his story, I took the liberty of Googling EVP and pulling up a site that has an example here. So I'll just play an example of EVP or white noise. Okay, here we go. Now, to me and to many others, of course, it sounds faked, but there's no doubt that this kind of thing can make the hair on the back of your neck stand up. It is a creepy sound. So anyway, if you're curious and want to find out more about what these people are talking about, it is called EVP, or white noise. Peoria State Hospital, also known as Bartonville State Hospital, also known as the Illinois Asylum for the Incurable Insane. A real place with a long list of allegedly ghostly encounters, it was a psychiatric hospital operated by the state of Illinois from 1902 to 1973, 47 buildings to the complex. The facility and the land now listed as a historic district on the National Register of Historic Places. Perhaps the most famous ghost story coming out of Peoria State Hospital was that of Old Book. Old Book wasn't a thing. Old Book was a man, a patient, Manuel A. Bookbinder. Although Bookbinder wasn't even his real name, nobody knew his actual legal name or identity. So Manuel A. Bookbinder, Old Book, became his name and identity. He was one of the most well-liked patients in the facility during his time at Peoria State Hospital. Old Book had a heart for people, empathy, a real depth of feeling. And it was long reported that whenever a patient died, Old Book would stand in the periphery during the outdoor burial services, lean against an old elm tree, and he would weep for the dead. For Old Book, this became the crying tree. Dr. George Zeller, the first director for the facility, was one of the first to report the story that follows, although many have allegedly corroborated it. When Old Book finally died himself, still a patient at Peoria State Hospital, still beloved, even in memory, his funeral was attended by hundreds of patients and dozens of staff members. And after the kindest of words were spoken on his behalf, workers began to lower the heavy casket into the earth. But at the top of the ropes, the workers suddenly became aware that the heavy casket wasn't really all that heavy. And they looked at each other, puzzled over the ease of the load. Suddenly, the graveyard elm, the looming tree that had for so long been the grieving companion of Manuel A. Bookbinder, emitted a guttural moan. An earthen scream, a heartbreaking wail that cannot be fully described for anyone who was not there that day. Dr. Zeller was himself in attendance, and he reported the events in his personal diary. Reports of the puzzled workers, the screaming elm, and the gasp of the crowd as a visage of Old Book leaned, as it had for decades, against the large tree. And then it disappeared. But the image was so clear, so real, so there, As the wailing sound continued, Dr. Zeller ordered the casket to be opened on the spot to verify the lifeless body inside. And when the lid was finally pried loose, the elm tree suddenly became as silent as the tomb itself. Old Book's body was there, still there inside the coffin. And in the days that followed, the old elm tree would begin to follow suit. Years would pass as the old tree transitioned into death and rot, but all efforts to move or remove it would fail. For everyone who put shovel to earth or axe to wood would rush in a panic from the scene, haunted by the screams, the terrible screams, the heart-sick screams. Lightning struck the tree one day, and its splinters were finally removed. But even today, passers-by this historical spot on this historical site claim to hear the cries of the otherworldly elm, the cries for Old Book, the cries for so many disturbed and tormented who had only found rest in death, the somber, mournful weeping of souls who will not be silenced by the grave. What is it about the tree that so often seems like it's one of us? It stands up like a person. It seems to show expression, sometimes a kind expression, sometimes a sinister expression. You know, there are whole websites dedicated to just photographs of trees, trees that seem almost human. And if you have one of those trees near your house this October, you've already got the perfect Halloween decoration. Jackie sent in a ghost story that said this, not ghosts really, but angels? This happened 35 years ago. It was late evening, a few days before Christmas. I won't give details, but I was suffering through one of the most emotionally painful times of my life. The doorbell rang. Five extraordinarily beautiful children stood there, each dressed completely in white. They couldn't have been more than 6 or 7 years old, but were not accompanied by an adult anywhere to be seen, and it was after dark. They sweetly asked if they could sing a Christmas carol for me. Of course I said yes. Although I'd forgotten what song it was, they had lovely child voices, so beautiful I was enveloped, and for a moment I forgot my pain. I remember a few tears escaping my eyes as I tried not to full-out sob. I thanked them and closed the door. Almost immediately, I remembered I'd made fresh-baked cookies and reopened the door to offer them a treat. They were gone. I looked up and down the street. They were nowhere to be seen. The next day, I was speaking to three of my neighbors, and I said, "Hey, didn't you enjoy the children who caroled last night?" And they looked at me and said, "What children?" Here are a couple of stories about haunted photographs. Our first story is the story of Mabel Chinnery. In 1959, she had gone to visit the grave of her mother. She turned to see her husband waiting in the car. She happened to have her camera, and she thought it was an image worth capturing. So she photographed her husband and the car, and then she went on to other things. When the photograph was eventually developed, her husband indeed sat behind the wheel in the photo, but he apparently had picked up a backseat driver. In the rear seat of the car, she could see a figure, a face in the shadow with blinding white eyes, stoic, pursed lips, and the black dress and white scarf that struck Mabel as familiar. And even today, those who gaze upon the reprints of the famous 1959 Mabel Chinnery photograph are said to see the very woman who had been buried only a few dozen yards away.
And if you want to see the photograph, it's Mabel, M-A-B-L-E, Chinnery, C-H-I-N-N-E-R-Y. The photograph allegedly taken in 1959. Here's another one. Reverend Ralph Hardy was a retired clergyman visiting the Queen's House section of the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich, England. Inside the Queen's House was an ornate, impressive, beautiful staircase. Reverend Hardy photographed the staircase. Reports say that the original negative of the image was examined by photography experts, even some who worked at Kodak, and the consensus was that this photo had not in any way been tampered with. The photograph of the Queen's House and its elegant staircase, and on the rails of the staircase, the hands of a figure not there when the picture was taken. Hands leading into the long sleeves of a long overshirt or robe, the sleeves leading toward blunted, broad shoulders, which led to the featureless head above. No eyes could be seen, no mouth, no ears. In the image, now visible on the internet, it looks as if a darkened veil has been lowered over the face. A veil masking a face that might be a grieving soul, an executioner, or merely the blurring of features as the clumsy camera briefly glimpsed the towering, climbing figure, hand over hand, arm over arm, pulling itself up the Queen's House staircase toward a destination unknown. The staircase was called, by the way, the Tulip Staircase, and you can Google that, the Tulip Staircase Ghost. Jen said, several months ago, I was sitting on a park bench near my house late one night. While reading something on my phone, several yards away from the nearest street lamp, out of the corner of my eye, a tiny moving light caught my attention. I looked up, squinting my eyes, but I couldn't seem to focus on the itty-bitty bobbing light. I set my phone down on the bench, plucked my glasses from my purse, and stood up. For a moment, I couldn't find the light, but a slight breeze whispered by, and the light returned. It wouldn't stay still more than a moment, zipping left and right, up and down. It was very white, longer and tapered at the ends, but still only a few inches in length overall. I took a few steps toward it, puzzled, but the wind picked up again, stronger, and just as suddenly as it had appeared, the light disappeared. For several days, my mind returned to that little light in the park. What had it been? Why had it moved about in such an odd fashion? A week later, I found myself back in the park late at night. Japan is really a safe country. After work, enjoying the warm summer nights. Once again, this little light appeared, several yards away, approximately in the same place as before. This time I was ready. I pulled out my phone and opened the camera. Aha! Silk. A spider and its fledgling spider web. Light bouncing off a shiny strand dangling between the trees. I smiled and chuckled. Silly spiders. It's funny, every single year I have requests to read for this very broadcast the classic Edgar Allan Poe poem, The Raven. And up to now I've resisted. It's such a familiar quantity. It's such a known poem. I didn't know if it would resonate with listeners. Last year I read Robert Service's poem, The Cremation of Sam McGee, by request, and it turned out to be a huge hit. People mention that to me everywhere I go. It's that they really enjoyed themselves. And so I'm going to go ahead and read for you tonight The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe. Poe's a fascinating character. His works have been in print since 1827. Among the most famous, of course, The Raven. Also The Telltale Heart, The Fall of the House of Usher, among others. Poe was one of the earliest short story writers in America. He's said to have been the one person who invented the genre of detective fiction, and he was hugely influential in sci-fi. Born Edgar Poe in 1809, his childhood was marked by trouble. His father abandoned the family when Edgar was only 1 year old. His mother died a year later. So he was adopted by John and Frances Allen, hence the Allen in Edgar Allan Poe. He spent some time in the army using a fake name, had some trouble there. He'd been through several marriages. He worked as a literary critic and a writer in several capacities. He'd already released a number of poems and other works by 1831 when tragedy struck yet again. The death of his older brother, Henry, who had long struggled with poor health, possibly due to alcoholism. In 1835, Edgar Allan Poe married his 13-year-old cousin, Virginia. She would die 11 years later of tuberculosis, and it's said her death may have served as the inspiration for many of Poe's darker writings during that time. The Raven was published in January 1845 in the Evening Mirror, and it became an instant and huge success. For this masterwork that would come to be remembered and recited well into the 21st century, Edgar Allan Poe was paid $9. He died October 7, 1849. All medical records regarding his death, including his death certificate, have been lost. Theories abound as to what happened to him, but the actual cause of death may never be known. Edgar Allan Poe died at only 40 years old. But his work and legacy, often a dark legacy, live on, including The Raven, a narrative poem which tells the story of a man mourning the loss of his life's love and confronted by a dark visitor whose presence serves to remind him of his grief and punctuate the madness born of it. Many would argue this is the defining work of Edgar Allan Poe, and it is the story you shall hear right now. It is The Raven. Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered weak and weary, o'er many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping, as of someone gently rapping, rapping at my chamber door. 'Tis some visitor, I muttered, tapping at my chamber door, only this and nothing more. Ah, distinctly I remember, it was in the bleak December, and each separate dying ember wrought its ghost upon the floor. Eagerly I wished the morrow, vainly I had sought to borrow from my book's surcease of sorrow, sorrow for the lost Lenore, for the rare and radiant maiden whom the angels name Lenore, nameless here forevermore. And the silken, sad, uncertain rustling of each purple curtain thrilled me, filled me with fantastic terrors never felt before, so that now to still the beating of my heart I stood repeating, 'tis some visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door. Some late visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door. This it is, and nothing more. Presently my soul grew stronger, hesitating then no longer. Sir, said I, or madam, truly your forgiveness I implore. But the fact is I was napping, and so gently you came rapping, and so faintly you came tapping, tapping at my chamber door, that I scarce was sure I heard you. Here I opened wide the door. Darkness there, and nothing more. Deep into that darkness peering, long I stood there, wondering, fearing, doubting, dreaming dreams no mortal ever dared to dream before. But the silence was unbroken, and the stillness gave no token, and the only word there spoken was the whispered word, Lenore? This I whispered, and an echo murmured back the word, Lenore. Merely this, and nothing more. Back into the chamber turning, all my soul within me burning. Soon again I heard a tapping somewhat louder than before. Surely, said I, surely that is something at my window lattice. Let me see then what thereat is, and this mystery explore. Let my heart be still a moment, and this mystery explore. 'Tis the wind, and nothing more. Open here I flung the shutter, when, with many a flirt and flutter, in there stepped a stately raven of the saintly days of yore. Not the least obeisance made he, not a minute stopped or stayed he. but with mine of lord or lady perched above my chamber door, perched upon a bust of Pallas just above my chamber door, perched and sat, and nothing more. Then this ebony bird beguiling my sad fancy into smiling, by the grave and stern decorum of the countenance it wore. Though thy crest be shorn and shaven, thou, I said, art sure no craven, ghastly rim and ancient raven wandering from the nightly shore. Tell me what thy lordly name is on the night's Plutonian shore. Quoth the raven, nevermore. Much I marvel this ungainly, foul to hear discourse so plainly, though its answer little meaning, little relevancy bore, for we cannot help agreeing that no living human being ever yet was blessed with seeing bird above his chamber door, bird or beast upon the sculptured bust above his chamber door, with such a name as Nevermore. But the raven sitting lonely on the placid bust spoke only that one word, as if his soul in that one word he did outpour. Nothing farther than he uttered, not a feather than he fluttered, till I scarcely more than muttered, other friends have flown before, on the morrow he will leave me, as my hopes have flown before. Then the bird said, nevermore. Startled at the stillness broken by reply so aptly spoken, doubtless, said I, what it utters is its only stock in store, caught from some unhappy master, whom unmerciful disaster followed fast and followed faster, till his songs one burden bore, till the dirges of his hope that melancholy burden bore, of never, nevermore. But the raven still beguiling all my fancy into smiling, straight I wheeled as a cushioned seat in front of bird and bust and door. Then upon the velvet sinking, I betook myself to linking fancy unto fancy, thinking what this ominous bird of yore, what this grim, ungainly, ghastly, gaunt, and ominous bird of yore meant in croaking, nevermore. This I sat engaged in guessing, but no syllable expressing, to the fowl whose fiery eyes now burned into my bosom's core. This and more I sat divining, with my head at ease reclining, on the cushion's velvet lining that the lamplight gloated o'er, but whose velvet violet lining with the lamplight gloating o'er, she shall press, ah, nevermore. Then methought the air grew denser, perfumed from an unseen censer, swung by seraphim whose footfalls tinkled on the tufted floor. Wretch, I cried, thy God hath lent thee, by these angels he hath sent thee, respite, respite, and nepenthe from thy memories of Lenore. Quaff, O quaff, this kind nepenthe, and forget this lost Lenore. Quoth the raven, nevermore. Prophet, said I, thing of evil, prophet still, if bird or devil, whether tempter sent or whether tempest tossed thee here ashore, desolate yet all undaunted, on this desert land enchanted, on this home by horror haunted, tell me truly, I implore, is there balm in Gilead? Tell me, I implore. Quoth the raven, nevermore. Prophet, said I, thing of evil, prophet still, if bird or devil, by that heaven that bends above us, by that God we both adore, tell this soul with sorrow laden if within the distant Aden it shall clasp a sainted maiden whom the angels name Lenore, clasp a rare and radiant maiden whom the angels name Lenore. Quoth the raven, nevermore. Be that word our sign of parting, bird or fiend, I shrieked upstarting, get thee back into the tempest and the night's Plutonian shore. Leave no black plume as a token of that lie thy soul hath spoken. Leave my loneliness unbroken. Quit the bust above my door. Take thy beak from out my heart, and take thy form from off my door. Quoth the raven, nevermore. And the raven, never flitting, still is sitting on the pallid bust of Pallas just above my chamber door. and his eyes have all the seeming of a demon's that is dreaming, and the lamplight o'er him streaming throws his shadow on the floor. And my soul from out that shadow that lies floating on the floor shall be lifted nevermore. Here's a story from Patricia. She said this. My grandmother died on December 25th, 1975. I was 22 years old at the time. Grandma had been hospitalized, and I was visiting my parents for the holidays. I knew it would be my last chance to see Grandma alive. We all visited her on Christmas Eve in her hospital room, even though she was comatose. As we were leaving the hospital at the end of visiting hours, my dad asked the nurses to please call if her condition changed, no matter what time it was. I remember the head nurse telling him they'd be checking on her every 15 minutes. We went back to my parents' house and were all sleeping by about 11:30. I was in the room I'd used while attending high school. Next to my bed on the nightstand was the old clock radio I'd once used as an alarm. The arms of the clock glowed in the dark so you could always tell the time if you woke during the night. Hanging on the north wall of the room above my bed was the last rites crucifix that my grandmother had given me as a Christmas gift in 1957. This type of crucifix is a two-piece wooden cross with a hollow center containing two small candles, a bottle of holy water and another with holy oil, and a little booklet containing the text of the last rites. She gave you the last rites for Christmas? To use the crucifix for its intended purpose, you have to hold the base, the part that rests against the wall when it's hanging up, firmly in one hand, and grasp the body of the Jesus figure in your other hand, then pull the two pieces in opposite directions, with the top, the Jesus-holding part, moving up the cross as you pull. Then you insert the upper part of the crucifix into the base by sticking the bottom, the part below Jesus' feet, into a little rectangular notch near the top of the base. And you stick the candles into two round notches in the arms of the base, forming a little makeshift altar. I was awakened during the night by a loud noise in the room. I noted the time as I rolled over, 4:21 a.m. I got up, switched on the light, and looked around, wondering what had caused the noise. On the floor below the south wall was the upper part of the last rites crucifix. The base was still hanging on the north wall. I grabbed a robe, went down the hall to my parents' bedroom, woke them up, and urged them to come to my room. While I waited for my parents, I picked up the upper part of the crucifix from the floor. I noticed the drywall a foot or so above where it had been laying had a rather deep gouge in it, as if that piece of wood had been flung into it very hard, and the bottom of the cross had some chalky drywall residue on the bottom end. Also, the Jesus figure was now hanging by just one hand, instead of being attached to the wood in three places. While the three of us were standing in my room collectively saying, "What the hell?" the phone rang. I noted the time on the clock radio read 4:33 a.m. It was one of the nurses at the hospital calling to say that when they checked on Grandma at 4:15, she was still breathing, but at the 4:30 check, she was dead. Well, I was curious about this story, so I contacted Patricia and asked her if she'd spend a couple minutes on the radio with me to elaborate. Patricia, thanks so much for joining me.
Hi, Seth.
So I wanted to follow up. Your grandmother died on Christmas Day, 1975. Were you a skeptic right at the time? Were you a non-believer?
I was kind of in between. I was wanting to be a believer, but couldn't persuade myself. I had been in that condition since about the fifth grade. They sent me to a parochial school as a child, and, you know, it seemed like a good idea. Everybody else believed, and I wanted to, but I just couldn't quite bring myself. So I sort of faked it, and then when I was about 13, I quit going to church altogether. I had that option.
So what was your perception of this crucifix that had
fallen and broken at this sort of key moment? At the time, did you think, hey, wait a minute, maybe there's something supernatural happening to creep everybody out?
Well, the first thing that I thought of it was, it's got to be my grandmother sending some kind of a message, and I have no idea how or what. If it is a message from her, what in the world could it mean? You know, I still have no idea to this day what happened that night and why. You know, I know that there's got to be an explanation somewhere, and hopefully one day I'll find out what it is.
Would it give you comfort to think that it was, you know, grandmother's giving us a kind of a message, hey, I'm still around kind of thing?
Not really. I wasn't that close to her. And, you know, the only reason I connected it with her was it was a gift. It had been a gift from her to me on Christmas when I was 4 years old. So that connected it to her. And we had just seen her, and she died at the same, probably right around the same time, you know, within a matter of minutes, either the direction she had died. So that's why I asked the question in the story title, Grandma's Ghost, you know?
Yeah.
But I really don't know. I mean, I can't imagine any natural occurrence that would cause something to fly across the room with such power that it gouged the wall, you know? I just can't imagine what would do that. Can you?
Well, I'm trying to envision it in my mind. I'm struck by perception versus reality. You know, what do we perceive and what really happened? The subjective human brain. Do we, in a time of crisis, find ourselves psychologically traumatized? And so the brain invents coping mechanisms and perhaps even gives agency to specific actions. You know, did someone go in there? Did someone grab the crucifix and, you know, in a moment of grief, throw it? You know, I have no idea what might have happened. I have no idea.
Well, it was just the three of us in the house, my parents and myself, and they were in the other end of the house in their room, and I was asleep, sound asleep. The sound is what woke me up. So
yeah.
When I went to tell them, they were sound asleep too. They hadn't heard anything because they were in the other end of the house, and they were just as amazed as I was.
It's an intriguing story, Patricia. Thank you for sharing it on this Ghost Stories radio broadcast. Much appreciated.
All right, thanks.
Did Patricia herself, maybe sleepwalking, get out of bed, grab the crucifix, and throw it? You know, that's always a possibility. Theories shall abound in the comments section, I have no doubt. Here's a story that's based out of Cambodia. One of the most popular tales, apparently, when it comes to ghosts, the paranormal hauntings, and the visits of the tormented dead upon the living. This story is about the Krause, K-R-A-U-S-E. According to Thai and Cambodian folklore, the Krause is a ghost of only partial body. Her head covered by long, flowing hair, draping down over a torso that remains incomplete. Below the neck and upper chest, there is no body per se. Or perhaps it's more accurate to say, there is no outer body. Dangling inside and beneath the floating upper torso and head are the rib cage, the beating heart, and internal organs of the Krause. And as the ghost moves hither and yon, one can see the sight and hear the slither of her intestines as they trail across the ground. The Krause, in life, was once a princess, and as she grew from a young girl into candidacy for marriage, a marriage for her was arranged. But she was not in love with the man who had been chosen for her. She was not ready yet to be a bride. The rejection of this sacred marriage custom was considered a disgrace, an affront, a crime against her family, against her nation, against God. And so she was made an example of, dragged into a public square, tied to a stake with kindling at her feet, and burned alive. And as the flames crawled up the screaming woman's body, engulfing her feet, her legs, her waist,
there was said to be a magician standing in the awestruck crowd. And with a subtle, almost undetectable wave of his hand, he cast a spell that turned the flames to mist before they could completely claim their prize, hoping to spare her pain and perhaps even her life. But alas, life had already spilled from the charred body of the princess, the partial body of the princess, her head hanging down, peering down, as if to visually take in the portions of herself that were no longer. It wasn't long before the screams of terror could be heard throughout the town, and time and again the descriptions lined up perfectly. A floating apparition with long flowing hair, an abbreviated line just below the neck, and bloody entrails slithering behind. And it is said that, as this princess was never given the chance to fall in love and bear a child by her own choosing, she punishes those she comes upon who look to do the same. Her victims are almost always women, pregnant women. The deadly encounters happening in the few moments before or the few moments after childbirth. The placenta nourishing its levitating ghostly carcass, and the sacrifice serving like the magic spell once did to ease its pain for one more night. Beware the Cambodian phantom, the horribly burned princess, the grouse, and its eerie train slithering behind. For if it stands above you, you may unwillingly become its next meal. As we hit right at the 1 hour mark on the broadcast, I'm going to go ahead and prepare to play for you my original ghost story to cap the show. I guess I call it a finale. I don't know if it's a finale. It constitutes more than one third of the total running length of the broadcast. This is a long form audio production. And so, again, I would encourage you, if you are at a place where you cannot commit the time, you might hit pause, you might make a bookmark, you might save it for a time when you can. Turn off the world, remove distraction, lower the lights, and really do it right and really enjoy yourself. Regardless, thank you for listening, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to sort of play in this particular sandbox. We spend so much time throughout the year talking about often very heavy issues related to atheism and religion and superstitious thinking and the damage it does. And a lot of times it's just nice to hit the brakes and just have some fun, just to do something else. Many people don't understand why people who don't believe in the supernatural can enjoy stories about the supernatural, which makes no sense to me. You know, I love the Harry Potter books. I love Lord of the Rings. I love Star Wars. You know, the fact that we are attempting to anchor ourselves in the real world so we can find real world solutions to our problems and live evidence-based lives does not mean we can't escape to fantasy, knowing it's fantasy, and have a hell of a time doing it. And I think that's what I hope to accomplish tonight. I'm not going to give you the name of the ghost story yet, because within the name sort of is the hook of the story. I'm going to save it until the very end. But for your approval, here it is, a project I finished just a couple of days ago, and it's my hope that it's engaging, entertaining, at least a little bit scary, and helps to get you into the spirit of Halloween. The house wasn't new. It certainly wasn't new to the Jacoby family. Built in 1931 in the place they'd called home for the past 11 months, it was a charming, two-story, slightly Victorian structure that brought both charm and challenge. Charming with a light blue exterior with the white pillars, the many old wooden windows with the chains and counterweights still in place. The old wood floors that hadn't seen a refinishing in far too long, and allow the children's shoes to glide and slide upon them.
the back porch swing gliding back and forth upon its conspicuously shiny new chains. The old ones had surrendered to decay long ago. The large trees that raised their mighty arms from the left and from the right, great protectors of this fragile antique living space. Even the old painted metal doorknob somehow evoked a feeling of comfort, warmth, and security. The wallpaper. Dear God, the wallpaper. It was more challenge than charm, certainly. Whoever it was that chose the dingy gray-gold color and the diamond pattern with the avocado green flowers, ugh. When the mortgage note was signed, it was immediately decided that the wallpaper would be one of the first things to change. Almost a year later, and the task had only just begun. A laborious effort, which required one of those huge, cumbersome steamers attached by hose to a wheeled reservoir of water, and which also required the strained, burning muscles of whoever's arm was charged to hold it up against the wall. From the beginning of the process, the house had revealed its reinventions and reincarnations from ages and residents past. The soppy, disintegrating wallpaper sloughing off to reveal layer after layer after layer of thick, hard, stubborn paint beneath. Like the rings of a tree, they could be counted like years, like decades. And Susan Jacoby found herself admitting to her husband, Rick, that she almost felt sad to strip the paper and paint, in many ways, the story of this place. Despite her desire to brighten the grays and put her own imprint upon the almost century-old interiors. But it was time. It was time. Time for a new chapter. Rick and Susan had two children, Tommy and Kimberly. Tommy was 16, going on 30. A tall, athletic, outgoing, brash, and occasionally exasperating teenager who could barely be told anything because he already knew everything. His favorite line was, "I know, Mom, you don't have to tell me." Tommy's room was a wild explosion of clean and dirty laundry, PlayStation games, unfinished homework, Legos — the guy loved Legos — and football posters, brandishing the players and emblem of Clemson University, his college dream. Although, and nobody could bear to tell him this, he'd never get there on a football scholarship. Tommy was loud and affable, his occasionally, hormonally short fuse doing nothing to diminish the kindness at his core, displayed most often when it came to animals. For so long, he'd begged his parents for a dog. But his parents had informed him it wasn't a good time to take on the extra responsibility, and so that day would have to wait. Kimberly was 11. Not Kim, not Kimmy. Kimberly. From almost the time she could understand the difference, she'd made this distinction clear. It was as if the abbreviations to her name were somehow an insult, a diminishing of the worthy name of Kimberly, and this would not be abided. Kimberly was confident without being prideful, and her strong, determined expressions almost had to be forced through her soft, fair features. She had a lean frame of 4.5 feet, which showed no signs of stopping. Auburn hair, big brown eyes, eyes that often destroyed her father's indignant parental rebukes and served as an almost immediate ticket to his embrace, his smile, and the safety of his lap on the easy chair. She was book smart. She was street smart. She was 5 years younger than Tommy, yet somehow seemed the older sibling, older in mind, older in wisdom. Like the wry, innocent face that would slay you with its naivety and innocence just before it beat you at poker. Precocious and practical, Kimberly could make her brother crazy, even as she was making him laugh. Neither sibling escaped wallpaper duty despite their Herculean efforts. The dining room had been first, the downstairs hallway remained. It was like trying to strip house paint with a Q-tip. It took forever, and it was just so boring. They worked in shifts after school, but Mom let him off relatively easy. While she'd toiled throughout the afternoons, the kids were only charged with 30 minutes before they could escape to their phones and friends. By Kimberly's estimate, they would finish sometime after her 20th birthday. But she dutifully scratched and steamed and scraped and steamed, picking at the outer skin of the ages-old hallway, and if she was to be honest, actually looking forward to having a happier color in this conduit, which connected the kitchen, the dining room, the living room, and her own room. Earbuds firmly in place, she worked, 30 minutes here, 30 minutes there, edging from right to left toward her bedroom, each swipe a revelation of what was hidden below. An inch at a time, a little bit more. It was actually rather relaxing, the mindless work allowing her thoughts to dwell on other things. An inch at a time, a little bit more. I wonder who used to live in this old, old house, who ate in my kitchen, who walked in my hallway, who slept in my room. An inch at a time, a little bit more. And then Kimberly stopped. The moist, crumbling wallpaper had fallen at this particular spot to reveal a letter, a capital letter. The letter K, carved into the heavy, oil-based paint with some kind of sharp instrument, a pocket knife probably. Kimberly continued to the left, revealing a C, then an O, then an N, and landing finally upon the final K, the first letter of the word, knock. "Hey, Mom, come here and look at this," she shouted toward the stairs. And it only took a minute for Susan Jacoby to lightly step from the upper floor to the lower to see what her daughter had discovered. "Huh," Susan said casually. "There's probably lots of stuff hidden under the walls of this place," she playfully told her child. "Keep digging. Who knows what else is under there?" Kimberly's 30-minute work requirement was almost up, but she wasn't going to stop now. So as her mother reconnected with whatever she'd been doing elsewhere, Kimberly began a kind of excavation. More letters, just to the left. Now it was a mission. An inch at a time. A little bit more. She steamed and scraped, actually having to retrieve more water from the tap just to keep the hot mist pounding against the stubborn gray and gold, the paint underneath it, the layers of skin refusing to go quietly, refusing to surrender, content to fall only in battle. But fall they did, and the next revelations came. Another K-N-O-C-K. Sitting on top of only half-exposed characters below, the lines spaced apart by about an inch and a half. And as Kimberly continued left, the first word on the top line saw daylight for the first time since, who knows? She was galvanized with purpose. She scraped and chiseled and picked and prodded, extending the radius of her worksite ever outward. The blank top space almost immediately revealing that the text only went down, and so down she worked. Another letter on another line, a letter before it, a letter after it. The letters melding together into words, inch by inch, until the enormous effort ultimately revealed the four lines engraved into the hard plaster. Knock, knock, knock. Yes, you can. Come play with the closet man. Again, she called to her mother, and while they both looked at it like one might look at an old coin discovered beneath the mud, neither had any idea what it was or what it meant. Likely an old children's game, they ultimately decided, and after Dad and Tommy toured the site of the find, dinner time discussion became a playful exchange of theories, guesses, and stories, with each of the four family members concocting their own imaginative explanations for the knock-knock-knock and the closet man. The words were scribbled rather low to the floor. Perhaps the closet man was a leprechaun. It was carved with a sharp instrument. Perhaps it was scored there by the wand of a witch. This lovely mystery owned the day, as the family laughed and wondered and carried on for hours into the night, when finally fatigue and the hard fact of the coming day sent them to their beds. Walking down the hall and past her discovery on the way, Kimberly couldn't help but smile as she playfully gave the wall a gentle rap of the knuckles with those three steps. Knock, knock, knock. Rick and Susan slept upstairs in the master suite, which wasn't really a suite. It was just a room, about as big as the other bedrooms. Tommy was just a door away from them. Kimberly was down below them, her ceiling almost directly connecting to her brother's room above. Kimberly didn't like to sleep in silence, so she kept a small fan by the bedside, one of those plastic clip-on fans that attaches to just about anything. Kimberly's was light blue, about 7 inches wide, and she'd clipped it to the lamp on the nightstand. The low hum and the cool breeze lulled her to sleep, as it had so many nights before. And the Jacoby home finished this day in a soft, silent peace. Have you ever woken up from a deep sleep thinking you'd heard a sound, but not entirely sure if you'd heard the sound or merely dreamed it? Kimberly's eyes had popped open and she felt her body jolt a bit, the familiar sensation of falling from unconsciousness and landing in reality. She held perfectly still. And after the requisite stares at the ceiling in an attempt to drift back to sleep, her eyes closed again in the darkness. Kimberly felt her eyes open. The sound hadn't come from the front door of the house or the back door. It was immediate, nearby, possibly inside her own head, especially after the events of the day. But then, suddenly, she heard a sound. A sound coming from inside the bedroom closet. Kimberly found herself flying toward her bedroom door before she even realized what was happening, bursting down the hall, up the stairs, exploding into her parents' room. "Dad, Dad, there's somebody in the house. There's somebody in my room." And Rick went from the peace of sleep into fierce, fast action. He was inside Kimberly's room only seconds later. But there was no sign of anyone, anywhere. In the closet, nothing. In the bathroom, nothing. Hallways, living room, kitchen, bedrooms, nothing. Room by room, methodically, Rick searched everywhere, flicking light switches, checking behind corners, opening doors that might normally stay closed for weeks at a time. Checking, searching. And finally, assuring his daughter that, "Hey, it's okay. It's okay, there's nobody here, baby. There's nobody here. You probably just dreamed it. It's going to be all right." The house was wide awake, but all were sympathetic and comforting. Rick, Susan, and Tommy each offered their own versions of, "It's okay, it's okay, you're safe, it's all right." It took some convincing. Kimberly had obviously carried a nightmare into a groggy, semi-conscious real world. But the fact was, no intruder was there, no evidence of forced entry, no sign of mischievous or malicious disruption of this peaceful place. Kimberly clutched fiercely onto her dad as he retraced his search, walking the house once again, every light switching on, pointing here, pointing there, to assure his daughter that they were still alone, still safe. Everything would be okay.
and Kimberly, refusing to go back to her own bedroom, retreated to the narrow space in the middle of her parents' bed, kicking and nudging them as she had when she was younger, before she'd become a big girl, ready for a big girl bedroom. Here, as always, she felt protected and insulated. Here, she was okay. It was just after 2 in the morning. It was the final knock that shook Kimberly from her exhaustion, the calm beat of her heart at rest pounding into a terrified timpani, and her lean frame bolted upright in the bed. In the bed. Not her parents' bed, but her own bed. How did she get here? How did she get here? Did Dad bring her down after she'd fallen asleep and she didn't realize it? Had the whole thing been a dream? Disoriented, Kimberly just looked around, blankly, getting her bearings as if she'd just stepped out of a vertigo-inducing carnival ride. Eyes forward, blinking, breathing. Okay, what was happening? What's going on? What's happening? What's going on? And then, just to her left, in the periphery of her vision, on the south wall of her bedroom, just above the old keyhole on the closet door, she saw the old painted doorknob began to turn. A little bit clockwise. A little bit counterclockwise. Back and forth. Back and forth. Never actually opening the door itself, but content to rock and rotate like the pendulum of a clock. Kimberly's first thought was escape. She tumbled from the bed and fell to the floor, her legs buckling with fear, refusing to let her stand. So she frantically crawled toward escape, toward the bedroom door. But though the bedroom door handle would turn, it would not open. She cried out, "Daddy! Daddy, somebody help me!" at the top of her lungs. Over and over she screamed it, her vocal cords rattling inside her throat with a strain. Yet no one heard. No one came. No one would open the door from the outside, the door that was now sealing her inside. And she reflexively kicked back into the far corner, legs tucked up to her chest, hands trembling, lungs heaving, her wide eyes locked on the closet door and the rolling, shifting doorknob. Suddenly, as the closet doorknob rolled counterclockwise to the height of its motion, it froze there before the sound of creaking as the closet door began to move. It edged outward on its old hinges, an inch at a time, a little bit more. The old painted door drifted from its resting place, opening like a ravenous mouth tilted to its side. An inch at a time, a little bit more, until the fully open closet revealed a place inside so black it wouldn't even acknowledge the moonlight bouncing from the windows to the walls, to the doors, to the floor. It betrayed no shapes of the contents within, no revelation, no clues, only darkness. She sat in the corner, as still as the furniture, eyes fixed on the open closet. She watched and she waited. She watched and she waited. Eternal seconds ticking by. The absence of sound, somehow unbearably loud. She felt like she was trapped underwater, not knowing when she might surface, and aching desperately to breathe. Suddenly, from within the closet, another 3 knocks. And an object rolled out of the darkness. A across the carpet toward Kimberly. It was a little red ball about the size of an apple, long ago retired from a little girl's playthings, dislodged from its assigned place on a shelf in the very back corner of the closet. Years ago, on a whim, Kimberly had taken her brush and some bright yellow paint, and she had painted two eyes, a tiny dot for a nose, and a wide, happy smile upon it. The tiny yellow face rolled and rolled as the ball rolled and rolled, gliding to a stop as it brushed against her leg, the smile staring at her from the floor. And then she heard the knocking again. Kimberly said nothing. Kimberly did nothing. She couldn't think of anything to say or do. A few seconds passed, and then the ball snapped back into the darkness behind the open closet door, drawn there in a flash by something unseen. And then the ball rolled out toward her again. More forceful this time. More direct. The message was clear. Play along. Play my game. The ball snapped back once more, and then once more rolled out from within the shadows. Kimberly's trembling hand reached down and took the ball. And after a few seconds of summoning every ounce of courage within her, she rolled the red ball back toward its place of origin, where it slipped and disappeared into the darkness. The now familiar knocks. And then a sound from directly beside her. The plastic keys of her tiny 25-key spinet piano had depressed, without fingers upon them. One by one they had depressed. Until this very moment, this instrument had always filled her room and her heart with satisfying, if imperfectly played, music. And the knocks and the notes sounded again, the raps of an unseen hand followed by the keys climbing upward step by step. Note by note, an unfinished progression in the five-note scale. Unfinished. Waiting, she supposed, for Kimberly to finish it. She felt like a marionette on the end of the strings, helpless to free herself of this performance. She slipped her right hand onto the side of the small piano and steeled herself in the silence, waiting. Waiting for the beginning and the middle of the sentence she was obviously being asked to finish. And so it began, even more slowly. C, D, E, F. Only the G remained. And so Kimberly's trembling index finger reached down, and then pressed down upon the G. Slowly and deliberately, with eerie purpose, the disarrayed pile of socks and drawings and dolls and discarded crayons, the floor-level debris through which she often had to navigate with careful steps, began to move. In the space that separated Kimberly from the open closet door, the clutter and encumbrances that littered the carpet swept slowly to the right and to the left, like the opening of a curtain, leaving a clear, uninterrupted path before her. Kimberly saw something that caused her heart to clash against her ribcage. From deep within the open closet door, from the place she had remembered hanging her clothes, boxing her shoes, stashing her games, piling the many details of her life that simply had nowhere else to go. From that place, she saw the blunt, ivory-white fingers emerge. Each drawn to a point by opaque, slightly rounded at the tip fingernails, stretching forward to reveal a large, obviously masculine hand, attached at the wrist to a forearm that was somehow both strong and slender, completely devoid of color, as if the blood had long ago been drained from it. Suspended there, less than 3 feet from the ground, the arm extended with the girth of a man, but the stature of a child. And then the open fingers pulled inward into a tightly wound fist. And the arm turned slowly to its side as the doorknob had only moments before, preparing to splash again against the wood. And then something spoke.
Knock, knock, knock.
You are it.
And then the fingers uncoiled and outstretched again, the hand lying limp in the air, the palm facing downward in an almost deferential way. What? Kimberly didn't understand. I'm what? And as another minute on the nightstand clock rolled over in the silence, the arm jolted and the fingers snapped back into a fist and pounded against the wood. There was a palpable impatience to it, even anger. More demand than a child's game, yet no one in the house came running at the sound. The whole world seemed deaf against the clamoring and the pounding and the knocking. And then the obvious occurred to Kimberly. I am it. The kid's game that she knew, that everyone knew, that was so simply understood and played by any and every child. She was it. And the next step in the game was the tag of a hand, the touch of a finger, the moment of contact when ownership could be transferred to another, and then, tag, you are it. No way, she said it aloud, speaking for the first time to the one who had imprisoned her in this frightful game. To it, to whatever it was. No. No way. And immediately the arm and the fist slammed against the closet door with a ferocity that rattled it on its hinges.
Knock, knock, knock. You are it.
If Kimberly had felt fear before, now it was laced with the danger of real, physical harm. She was faced with a choice that wasn't really a choice at all. Remain locked inside this cage as the otherworldly voice howled and the raging fist splintered the doors and walls. Or obey. Play along. Play the game. The lock on the bedroom door slowly turned and clicked. The message was clear. She wasn't going anywhere. You are it. And a lifetime passed as Kimberly wondered how she might ever will herself toward the deathly white hand piercing out of the midnight black of the closet. Yet there was no alternative. There was no alternative. The very next move was hers. Deceiving herself into bravery or foolishness, this 11-year-old girl slouched forward, slightly forward, onto her hands and knees with the careful finesse of a cat. And moment by moment, inch by inch, She pressed herself across the floor, toward the closet, toward the darkness, toward the outstretched hand. Inch by inch, her breathing deliberate, inch by inch, her muscles as tight as a drum, inch by inch, ready to leap backward in a heartbeat. And yet she continued forward. And as she drew within mere feet of her ghostly playmate, Kimberly, still crouched on the carpet, took her right hand and extended it forward, inch by inch. So close, so terrifyingly close. The fingers slowly unbending, straightening, drawing forward and upward, as if caught by a faint magnetic field, drawn toward the trembling hand of its reluctant counterpart as the distance closed between them. 10 inches. 7 inches. 4 inches. 2 inches. And then the hand lurched forward, grabbed her at the wrist, locked its grip as she recoiled in shock, and the bloodless, deathly cold arm slowly began to retract. Kimberly's voice rediscovered itself, and her scream rattled the bones of the old house with such ferocity, it immediately, finally shook Rick, Susan, and Tommy from their deep, unnatural sleep, and the second floor rumbled and boomed with a frantic, panicked rush from their rooms to the stairs leading down. Kimberly struggled and thrashed, her free arm both flailing wildly and desperately trying to unpry the hand, her legs kicking frantically, knocking the wall, knocking the closet door, kicking and pounding and slipping and edging in the one direction she desperately did not want to go. And yet she did go, inch by inch, inch by inch. The black inside this children's closet swallowing the arm and then the wrist. And when the darkness finally touched the wild, flailing, trapped, desperate animal that was this little girl, the arm pulled backward with a snap. Kimberly's tiny frame lurched forward like a rag doll, and the closet door thundered shut. And then the space inside these four walls was as silent as a grave. Until Kimberly's mother, father, and brother burst through the door, wild with shock and disbelief. Rick looked around and tried in vain to understand what was going on, to locate his baby girl, to rescue again his only daughter. But he could see no girl to rescue, even though he had heard her desperate voice inside this room only a few seconds before. And then he heard something directly to his left, and the entire family turned to face the wall. Scraping, scratching into the wall from behind the wall, from inside the space where there should have been structure and studs and wires and insulation, a single, slightly rounded at the tip fingernail protruding through, digging with purpose into the old painted plaster. Until the work was finally done and the fingernail withdrew and only the message on the wall remained. Knock, knock, knock. My new friends. Playtime with me never ends. And the bedroom door began to creak on its old hinges, slowly closing the gap that had spilled one room into another, until the final metallic click of the latch and the visible turning of the lock. And as one door closed, another door opened, and the Jacoby family stared into the darkness, the unnatural impossible darkness of the bedroom closet. This terrified, captive audience frozen in fear. What eventually broke the silence wasn't the sound of anyone speaking. The sound came from the corner, from the toy spinet piano sitting on the floor, right next to a little red ball with its eerily gleeful smile and stare of yellow paint. This captive audience listening to the familiar tones of a familiar scale and the familiar sound that accompanied them. The sound that would come to envelop, to encompass, to swallow the lives and memories of the Jacoby family, who would never be seen or heard from again. The sound. The sound. I called the story, of course, The Closet Man. And thank you so much for listening to it and the entire broadcast tonight. I hope you and yours have a wonderful Halloween holiday as we edge toward the 31st, and I will see you next time on the Thinking Atheist Radio Podcast. Take care.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on the Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.